Good afternoon and welcome to the Sitka Nature Show. This is your host, Matt. I want to thank you for joining me here in the second weekend of June 2019. Not too far away from the summer solstice, definitely into the summer season here. It's been a full couple of weeks for me since I was last on the air. I was on a guest naturalist on one of the small cruise lines here in Southeast Alaska and took a week-long trip that started in Juneau and went to Tracy Arm and Ideal Cove, saw kind of the, I guess they called it an iceberg garden near the terminal moraine of the LeConte Glacier, and then also got to go check out not quite all the way up to the Baird Glacier, but kind of a moat that's out at the front of the Baird Glacier with some large chunks of ice, and walk around a little bit on the moraine, a couple places or some places I had never been before, including Cake. And I know that there are folks listening in Cake to Raven Radio, and I just wanted to say I really enjoyed the experience that I had in Cake as part of this trip. And I know many of the guests on there after finishing the experience in Cake were said that it was one of their favorite parts or their favorite part of the trip to that point. Having had that experience, I want to thank the people of Cake for their wonderful welcome, and especially to Fallon, who took us around and spent most of the time talking to us, sharing a bit about her story and perspective and the culture of Cake. It was great to hear her speaking, as well as Michael Jackson and his wife, whose name slips my mind, but is related to one of my neighbors. So it was great to get a chance to talk with them just briefly there and hear from Michael about carving and carving traditions. And then also had a chance to talk briefly with Marvin Kadake at the dance performance. And it was nice to shake hands with him and be greeted by him. And then also hear a little bit about his experiences and his time in Sitka and those moments that I had to speak with him. So thank you to everybody in Cake for that welcome. I know the visitors appreciated it from the ship, and so did I as a visitor to the community of Cake. We're less than 2 weeks away from the summer solstice and a lot going on out there in this season of light. I'd love to hear what you're seeing. Please feel free to send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com, or get on Facebook and like the Sitka Nature page there. The conversation I have for this week's show is one I recorded back in May with Chris Rurick, a writer and naturalist who is visiting Sitka for a friend's wedding. And we'll go ahead and join the conversation with he and I talking a little bit about what we mean in our approach to being a naturalist.
I call myself an amateur naturalist.
Yeah, I liked the, and I still use it sometimes, aspiring naturalist. It's kind of the way that I like to put it.
I was thinking one time I got into an argument with a fellow birder who also was interested in much more than just birds, who she thought the term amateur naturalist was not something to aspire to.
Yeah.
And we had it out, and I was trying to advocate for the proud tradition of being a naturalist, not necessarily with formal training, but by dint of just going out there all the time and seeing what you can learn.
Yeah, it's... I mean, a lot of naturalists over the years, I guess, have been, well, some of them have been well off, you know, and made impressive discoveries and so forth. And, you know, in this modern era of specialization, where people are especially getting into genetics and all of that kind of thing, there's, you know, certainly in the schooling side of things, maybe there's places where you can get just kind of a general naturalist degree, but it seems like mostly it's focused on particular, often lab-based sciences or wildlife stuff, but with a heavy dose of genetics and that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the beauty of the amateur is that, you know, you're not tied to very, you know, cutting-edge research or, you know, needing to tie everything back to a certain field or have expertise in any one field, but you're able to draw from a lot of different areas of interest, and you know, I'm a writer as well, so I draw in a lot of literature when I'm out. I'm also someone who's very interested in just being, you know, locally present in my Pacific Northwest homeland, and can kind of carry that like wide-ranging knowledge. Is something, yeah, definitely I aspire to. That's a good way of putting it.
Yeah, it's a person that I know, his name is Richard Carsonson. He's lives in Juneau. He's a self-taught naturalist over, you know, taught in large part by spending time out, you know, out on the land, basically. Co-author of The Nature of Southeast Alaska with Bob Armstrong and Rita Eau Claire. And I remember probably the first time I met him and was talking to him, and we were just talking about sort of natural history and our approaches. And he said, you know, the way you like to think about it was a naturalist is a generalist in subject area, but a specialist in place. And for me, that's like very much spot on. It's like anything that's here, I'm interested in. But as you get farther away from here, I'm less interested. It's not that it's uninteresting. It's just that there's only so much you can do. And so I choose to focus geographically rather than subject matter wise.
Yeah, I mean, just coming here a few days ago, this is a very familiar feeling environment to me, having grown up around Puget Sound near Tacoma. I feel very at home in the forest, and a lot of the species are the same here, although in different kind of proportions. Yeah, I wanted to be able to go out into the environment here with my trusty notebook in hand and start immediately jotting notes about like, oh, this is interesting. Oh, this is interesting. But I couldn't really do it because at first had to kind of just like, you know, walk around with wide eyes and just see what I could see. And it's hard to, you know, make interesting observations when your eyes are so fresh in a place.
Yeah.
And so it was very cool walking around with you the other day, just because you kind of have this base knowledge of everything that's around, and you're able to cue in on things like that are now suddenly blooming, or a moth that's suddenly flying now or something.
Yeah, I went out. There was a person, actually, I don't know what his main thing was, but he was here. He was working on poetry, and his thing was the 57th parallel. Latitude 57, and he's from Denmark, and he and his family came over here for I think like 3 months, Mads, and he got in touch with me, found my website, and was interested in exploring along the 57th parallel, which is just south of downtown, and then on Kruzoff Island there's a stretch that it goes across, cuts across there, and so we went out and stuff, and it was interesting to go out with him because, I mean, he's from a completely different continent, so he doesn't even have the familiarity with like Puget Sound area. My sense is probably there's not that many things that are here which aren't there, but there's several things that have dropped out by the time you get up here, and just a few maybe have started to come in.
Yeah.
For him, it was completely new. So going out with him and where like everything was new, of course, it's overwhelming. And so for one, that offered kind of a sense of perspective, seeing that he was just trying to make sense of all this stuff that was completely new. And I was taking it for granted at some level, you know, it's just like, I recognized it. And so, you know, answering his questions and talking to him about it and just kind of seeing that it was an interesting sort of perspective, because on the one hand, you want to kind of have the new eyes because it becomes easy to overlook things that you just, because you've never really seen them, you know, they're there. And for whatever reason, that you just have tended to gloss over those things.
Yeah.
And sometimes somebody with new eyes will go, what is this? And you're like, oh, that's funny. I mean, I must have seen it before, but I don't really remember it.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, as you're saying, it's just kind of this like the wall of green thing where it's just too much. Can't really make sense of it and start to you know, it's funny. Yeah, it's just making sense of it, really.
It's also seeing the forest first and then getting down to the trees, mm-hmm. and then the lichens on the trees.
Right. Yeah.
But
yeah.
I that's a cool idea about the parallel. One sort of framing notion that I have that's still pretty nascent, but I think could be interesting as kind of a lifelong project is trying to become a citizen of the Ring of Fire, and the whole Pacific Rim, especially the places where you have that subduction zone, mm-hmm. and volcanoes and very active tectonics and earthquakes. I've been fortunate or unfortunate to be in several large earthquakes now, totally happenstance. And, you know, having grown up with volcanoes right outside my back door, all those things, you know, as I think about it more and more, it feels very relevant to kind of the existence we have on this narrow edge of the Pacific Ocean. So I'd love to be able to explore that. You know, Chile has a lot of the same ecosystem types.
Right, the temperate rainforest, yeah.
Uh-huh. Japan is really interesting, and getting up into Siberia as well. The Aleutians have always... I'd love to go out there.
Yeah, that's an ambitious, that's a lot of country to cover.
It
I guess is kind of what that looks like.
Yeah. I studied geology in college, and that one's interesting to me because of the variability in time scale. It just, it skews with your perspective from, you know, what it takes to build up a volcano like Edgecumbe or Mount Rainier to, you know, how fast a landslide can bring so much of it down. The scales are so different.
Yeah, geology is one that I'm only sort of starting to, like, I don't have any training in geology whatsoever. So as people have come through, they're geologists or I've read or whatever. So I'm starting to pick it up. Baranof Island doesn't have a geology that is compelling to many geologists.
Yeah. I looked before I came and I was like, oh, too bad. No fossils here.
Yeah, no fossils, no like gemstones or things like that. There's, you know, jasper, which I guess you can kind of do some polishing of and it can look kind of cool, but it's not super exciting. I have found one fossil here. It's actually not in town. It's a little north of town, but and it wasn't a very exciting fossil.
What was it?
It was a buccia, an old. I guess they're bivalve something, and they're 70 million years old or something. I can't remember, but they're kind of indicative of a certain time era. And it wasn't even a full. It was just like there was some grooves in the rock, and it looked kind of like a partial shell thing. But it was kind of cool just because it was a fossil. So that was fun.
Yeah.
I know elsewhere in Southeast Alaska, there's some amazing fossils that have been found and just, you know, amazing fossil beds where it's like the fossils are just kind of like, oh, yeah, if you want to find an ammonite or whatever, there they are. You know, no big deal.
Yeah. One of the things I do is I work at the Burke Museum in Seattle, mm-hmm. which is the big natural history museum there. And I work in invertebrate paleontology, kind of organizing the collections and getting things in order. And there's quite a bit of stuff from Southeast Alaska. Mm. And then, growing up in Western Washington, I just assumed it was kind of all, you know, young dirt, glacial silt type stuff, but there are actually quite a few fossil localities scattered around, and it's just very cool to see kind of how the ecosystems have evolved over the years. You can find on the Olympic Peninsula, you can find these amazing crab fossils in the middle of like round sandstone nodules.
How old are those? So they were... Is it kind of like the sandstone in California where it was kind of coastal and then it just uplifts and
so I haven't been to those localities, so I don't know exactly what it looks like on the ground. But they're about it's definitely harder rock than some of the coastal sandstone I've seen in California. Mm-hmm. You couldn't scratch it with your fingernail. And those the crabs are usually like Eocene, so not as old as dinosaurs, but I don't know off the top of my head, but yeah, like on the order of 10 to 20 million years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. That's been a minute. So yeah, it is. It's, my brother lives in Western Washington and he's got into rock hounding lately. And so he and my parents live in Idaho. And so they'll sometimes travel and meet in the middle somewhere to go find rocks, agates or whatever. And, you know, part of that's the volcanic history or the geology of, you know, the various types of geology of the area that gave rise to these rocks, and then the weathering, I guess, and somehow all that fits together. And of course, growing up here, I never really paid that much attention to those kinds of things. So it sounds like you did like in coursework, geology was your area.
So I'm mostly a writer, and I majored in creative writing, which I sort of wish I had majored in science. Not that I would have stopped writing. And then I did a lot of geology coursework somewhere between a minor and a major in terms of credits because, A, I like to get out and camp with my professors and classmates and just poke around the landscape. I came to find especially the paleobiology really fascinating and just the way it kind of, you know, gives us a much greater understanding of the diversity of life and the evolution of life and it's a really spotty record, but it's got a lot to say.
Yeah. And so is that how you got into natural history more generally, or were you already interested in that?
Always been interested. Yeah. Always been outdoors, you know, whether it was spending time on my grandparents' farm growing up, which is mostly forest, or going on camping trips all around the West. You know, we never traveled really outside of the Western U.S. We just drove in my parents' minivan, pop-up trailer, and they took us everywhere.
Yeah, it's, you know, I grew up here and was running around in the woods or whatever, and certainly hiking. But when I was in high school, I would go hiking with friends just up the mountains or whatever. But I didn't really have any awareness of natural history as a thing. Like, there's a certain amount of it. It's just like you're playing as a kid and you find the seaweed that you can squirt people with or whatever. So there's exactly. a certain amount of that that goes on. And it's been fun as an adult to just note the things that I remember from when I was a kid, because I had nobody that was really trying to get me to know nature stuff. I was just like, I was playing outside.
Yeah. What we did was, one of the things we did was crab wars.
Oh, yeah.
You know, bust
oh,
up in yeah. some mussels or clams and then put it in the little gravel pool in, on the beach and watch the crabs go to battle over it.
Yeah. I never participated in that, but I definitely was, I was there when other people were kind of like, let's have a crab fight.
Yeah. And there's a lot to be said for having that kind of like tactile, playful, you know, maybe more respectful as an adult.
But, yeah.
That sort of, you know, and a lot of the naturalists and scientists I've met do retain a lot of that sort of joker spirit as they explore the world around them.
My kids used to make, they would catch bullheads, the little sculpins in the tide pools with broken, busted up muscle, basically. I never thought of that. I remember trying to catch bullheads, but I was never clever enough.
We
was never
hot
dedicated
dogs.
Hot dogs.
What species is that here?
The tide pools, the sculpins? Well, sculpins are challenging, but okay. the tide pool sculpin is common, but there's also other sculpins.
Okay.
Fluffy sculpin, and I don't remember the... I don't remember. Like there's some genera that are popping through my head, Oligocotus and Clinocotus. That's a sharp-nosed sculpin, I think. But I have not really mastered the fish.
Okay. It's just curious because the one we have is Leptocotus armatus, the Pacific staghorn sculpin.
Oh, I think that's one that's around as well.
Okay. But we called it bullhead too.
Yeah. I think that's kind of the generic. I don't know why. But buffalo sculpin. My daughter especially liked to catch the sculpins and the tide pools. And there's actually a freshwater one that's in the river here.
Oh, wow.
That goes into saltwater too. But so I didn't. Yeah, I've learned a lot more about fish since as an adult, and my kids caught a lot more. I was, I ran around and stuff, but I wasn't really that interested until later as an adult. And so just, and the funny thing is, I know there are things that I had to have seen. I just had to have, because they're so common, and they're not really that. They're common and like red-breasted sapsucker, for example, bright red head, woodpecker thing. The first woodpecker I remember seeing was actually my the night of my senior class party. You know, we finished up at the Elks Club, and I was walking home, and I saw one fly into a tree, and I go, oh, we have woodpeckers here. And I had a vapor route for 5 years. Those things are on utility poles all over the place. Mm. And I just, like, I can't imagine that I wasn't around them, but I just, they're not in my awareness.
Yeah.
Buried thrushes, they're in my awareness. Like, they were something. Robins were in my awareness. So, yeah, it's interesting how much I missed. But were you kind of into the diversity of life and so forth from a young age, or did you find that that's something that caught your fancy later?
I was always, as a kid, I think I was always a book lover first. Mm-hmm. And I read a lot outside, and I poked around a lot outside. But I remember having these books that were, like, really well illustrated encyclopedias of animals, and I would just page through it and tell my parents the names of everything in it, you know, all these like wildebeest from Africa and whatever. And somehow I'm a birder as well, and so I have that strong like collector instinct, and then I always have throughout my life. But somehow, as I was coming into adulthood, I didn't necessarily connect the dots that the natural world was something that could be kind of explored with the depth that now I now know it can be, and that it would, well, birds are a good example. I didn't realize just the diversity of birds out there, and I remember I was living on my grandparents' farm in the winter, kind of rainy weather, and started paying attention to the birds a little more, just because, you know, there were a lot of waterfowl out on Puget Sound nearby, and I was looking out there one day, and I put my binoculars on a bird, and it was a common loon. And I was like, what? There's loons here? I love loons. I had a stuffed loon as a kid. I thought they were just in Minnesota. And you know, that really sparked me to go to the library, where I realized there was like four shelves of books about what birding is.
Yeah.
I just wanted a field guide, but I ended up checking out a bunch of them and staying up all night reading. And then I was like, wow, there's a lot to find out here. And then soon after, there was also, you know, I had been noticing that there was a small flock of chickadees and kinglets and nuthatches that was coming through a tree right next to where I was staying. And I was looking at them one day, and all of a sudden, you know, my binoculars go onto a bird, and it's bright yellow with a black face. I'm like, what the heck is that? It looked like it was straight out of the tropics. Looked it up in the book. It was a Townsend's warbler.
So it was.
Yeah. And they winter in small numbers in Washington.
Yeah.
And yeah, so that really, you know, got my juices going. And, you know, simultaneously, I had been getting more interested in kind of cataloging the flowers I had been seeing along the way, or at least learning names. I think just I'm someone who likes to be aware of my surroundings.
Yeah.
And so learning the names of things, it feels like this first step in that direction.
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of, I like to think about it as getting to know the neighbors.
Yeah.
And I don't, you know, there's different approaches. Some people really, like, they get super into one thing. And, you know, it's like they really build a relationship with a mink or whatever, you know, and sometimes even an individual animal. And that's, you know, there's a lot to be said for that as well. But I've tended to be much more like, it's not that I have no interest in doing that. It's that my interest has been to mostly, sometimes I describe it as in the old days when the internet was slow, and you could see pictures loading because it was slow. There was a couple different ways they would load. One of them was called interlaced, and that's like you get a blurry version of the whole thing, and then it would kind of refine. And then there's the other way, which was non-interlaced, which would be one line at a time, and each line was what it was going to be. Like you had the full image there, but it took a while for the whole thing to load. And you know, in the end, they would be the same. You know, it would be the same image. It was just a matter of how it loaded. And so for me, my instinct has been much more the interlaced approach. Like I want to have a broad view of everything and then refine kind of thing. You know, I don't know how that works in practice, but that's the way that I've tended to think about it. So I've tended to try and learn names of things, you know, recognize what I see, take advantage, because some things are just hard in the end. I mean, I still have a belief that most things in an area probably aren't that hard if you could ever figure out what they were in the first place.
Yeah.
The hard part's figuring out what they are in the first place. And getting because the names help to sort, like that helps you make sense of it. So like when you're just coming in, you don't know the names of anything, you know, you don't have any cubby holes essentially to start to,
right.
to distinguish things. And so lichens are still like that. I mean, it's less than it used to be, but I just still like I see crust lichens and I'm like, I don't even know where to begin. There's a lot of them.
It's funny. The challenge at the Burke Museum with the paleontologists is, you know, they have very deep knowledge in, you know, most of them have pretty broad across all invertebrates, but they'll throw out names, and it could be a genus name, it could be a species name, it could be a family, it could be even like, you know, order, class, any level of the tree. You know, you're expected to kind of like know kind
They'll
of
just
where
assume
that puts
that,
you
yeah,
on the
yeah.
tree of life.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess I find myself doing that more as time goes on because I just take that for granted. You know, you get familiar enough with it. But it is a little bit, I have to remind myself sometimes when I'm talking with people. It's like I try and calibrate. I know I'm talking about plants. And I have this weird, like I have both common names and scientific names in my head. And I have a lot where I have both for the same, you know, I have multiple names for the same organism, same species. But sometimes I remember one or the other more readily. And it isn't like I don't consistently remember scientific names or consistently remember common names. It's like for some things I remember common names more easily and other things I remember scientific names, which makes it I don't quite know what to say to people. They're like, well, what's this flower? And I'm like, well, how much do you really want to know? Like, well, you know, how much detail do you want about that? And so it was fun to go out with you because you're like, you're the first person I think that I've Well, certainly the first visitor that's come here that's been like, oh, yeah, I want to look at all the moths on the building. There's a few other people that are willing to look at moths and stuff like that. But mostly folks are like, birds are pretty popular and plants.
I can imagine. Yeah.
Plants are popular with folks. But
well, moths, as I told you, I feel like I've been developing an interest in all Lepidoptera and moths and butterflies, but moths in particular, A, because I've come to recognize the great diversity that shows up around Puget Sound, and specifically on one wall at the farm that I find myself traipsing along at night, and there might be 10 species on it on a given night, or nothing.
Yeah.
But yeah, like I mentioned to you, I used to be somewhat terrified of moths, and in college I went so far as to write a short piece saying how evil moths are. I think it had the line that they're Knight Riders birthed in Satan's closet. And so I feel like I'm paying penance to all of Mothhood for writing those words about them when they're beautiful and fascinating creatures.
Yeah, there's a lot of just diversity of form and color, decoration, and then you get into the tropics or whatever, like around the world, it's really incredible. Here it's nice. I mean, it's interesting, there's a lot of diversity, but as you go away, and for here there are butterflies here, but like I've seen 5 species of butterflies, I think.
Oh, wow.
In Sitka, if you get to them, they don't seem to like the damp climate. there's a couple of there's some spring fall flyers where they're overwintering as adults. So there's a couple of species that are pretty well. One that morning cloaks are kind of annual.
Mm-hmm.
Milbert's tortoise shells are semi. They're probably annual, but they don't seem to be seen as often. Red admirals show up sometimes. I think they. Especially one year, we had a bunch of them. I think there was just a big incursion north. Hmm. The one that's the most common is the margined white, which is a cabbage, cabbage butterfly. There's an introduced one that looks very similar. That's kind of a pest, I guess, on brassicas. if you're growing vegetables. And then there's one that it's a copper. And that was my daughter caught one a few years ago, and I was like, "Well, I've never seen anything like that before." And it looks like when you see it, it's kind of charismatic looking. It's got the kind of orange bronze with spots and stuff, and so it looks kind of cool.
It's very small, right?
Yeah, it's pretty small. Maybe an inch long, and I had never seen one before. And I think it was maybe one of only a small number of records from the state. And there's a person that was spent years, decades, really doing Lepidoptera surveys in Alaska. He's since passed away, Ken M. Phillip, up at the University of the North in the Museum of the North at the University of Alaska. He's kind of working with there and with the Smithsonian, and he saw pictures. He's like, oh, that's the Reichert's coppered or something like that. It's I can't remember the genus, but Mariposa, and then it's a subspecies like the Queen Charlotte. Subspecies or something like that. And I said, yeah, it must have flown in. He goes, no, they're probably there. I said, okay. I don't know. I haven't seen them. They seemed pretty distinctive. But then last summer I was out and I noticed this like fast flying moth is what it seemed like. I saw it and tried out in a muskeg is mm-hmm. where it was and kind of tried to track it down. And it turned out to be one of these butterflies. And then I realized that these butterflies are flying around. They're flying around pretty fast. They're not very big. They probably have a relatively small window of flight time, would be my guess.
Uh-huh.
And then I ended up finding a bunch of them, like several. So enough to make me go, oh, these are probably regular here.
And you may have been writing them off as moths,
right?
Before.
Yeah, just moving quickly as moths. They're not like the bigger ones where their wings are obviously kind of flapping and they're just kind of doing their thing.
Yeah, bouncing back and forth.
Yeah, these were like flying directly and moving quickly, which when you're walking around a muskeg here in the summer, it's often that you get little moths that are flying up and then they just go land and hide and that kind of thing. So
do you know what those guys feed on?
I don't. I'm not sure what their life cycle is. I haven't figured that out. But something in the muskeg, I guess. I was, like I said, I was surprised last summer to see them. And now I'm thinking, well, I probably could find them every year. If the weather, if you get the right time of year with the nice weather, I don't know if they're active when it's rainy, and sometimes it's pretty rainy. So, but it was sunny days when I was seeing them last year. So yeah, it's going to be on my list of things to go. It's like every year there's this thing, okay, I'm going to go. and over time, it's like, reacquaint myself with these things. Over one of the things that, like, we were out yesterday, it's like, oh, that's the first time I've seen this blooming this year, kind of thing. So that's one thing that I enjoy doing from year after year. But there's also the insects or the birds, you know, mm-hmm. and that first of the year thing is something that I enjoy.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. I just saw my first painted lady of the year down in Washington.
Oh, nice. Yeah. I've seen those here too, but that was one I didn't mention, but they might be school releases.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Yeah, you never know.
Yeah, they're probably just native. Yeah,
yeah. I've read they're one of the most cosmopolitan species of butterfly mm-hmm. all over the world.
And when you buy the butterflies to raise, I guess those are often what you end up with.
I see.
So I don't. They could fly in. I don't know that they. I don't. It's not my sense that they are resident here, but it's also possible that they could fly in from somewhere else. Because mm-hmm. I guess they can go a long ways. So they're pretty common in Puget Sound area?
Fairly common, yeah. 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 Yeah, I don't know how long they fly. I'm not sure. But yeah, all of this is why I love, you know, being a naturalist, because it's kind of all based on observation and story. And to me, ecology is the natural science that really appeals to me most, because it is the science based on storytelling, and kind of you have characters and they're interacting, and you know, they have different motives.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's almost a plot to it, and it's based on kind of like time in the field and personal observation, and a lot of it, you know, it's been made to be mathematical in many ways, but I think it's avoided like a lot of natural sciences, biology, for example. You know, there's a tendency towards lab yeah. based work,
highly quantitative. You know, mm-hmm. so we can throw some stats at it, high powered stats. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. There has been that tendency, which I like the. I joke sometimes that I you know, if there's a continuum of like pure just haphazard natural history observation to and pure just dealing with numbers and data, I like both ends, and the sciencey stuff in the middle I find tedious and not very very much fun. I like it when I like people to do it and give me data to work with, and I like talking to them about it on the other side and just like getting the natural history side of it. But yeah, that sort of structured data gathering kind of stuff in the middle I find challenging for my own sort of personal preferences,
yeah,
in ways to spend my time. And you're, you know, I noticed you carry a notebook around, and it's always interesting to me how people approach their, you know, whether they're birders, you know, almost exclusively birders or more generalists or whatever, the way that people kind of document, you know, their experiences. And I compulsively carry a camera and pretty much never write anything down. except in notes with my photos when I process them later. But a lot of people, I know people that carry around books and have to replace their bird books every few years,
right,
because they're full of notes in the margins and notebooks. You know, one person in town has just volumes and volumes of journals, many of which are illustrated or, you know, letters are feather taped in or various things mm-hmm. like that. So I noticed you carry a little field notebook and make notes to yourself along the way. But yeah, I'm curious about kind of your process with all of this.
Yeah, so this is my constant companion, and whether I'm out in nature or, you know, in a meeting or doing my, you know, writing related stuff, for basically any thought that pops into my head that seems worthwhile, I'll put it in there. And in a way, it's beautiful because it's a jumble, just like life can be.
Yeah.
Natural history-wise, I like to sketch. I'm not a great artist. I have shaky fingers, but I do my best to sketch things when I'm outdoors. I often carry a camera, and it's kind of revolutionized my way of being outdoors, because I can, you know, much more confidently try to identify stuff after the fact based on the photographs I've taken, or take a photograph and sketch it. You know, sketching is just like a great way to kind of cement details in your mind, or really get a feel for the shape of, you know, an insect's body, for example, and you know, as you're, you know, why is it contoured this way? Does it have to do with the way they live, you know, or the environment they live in? And when I was doing environmental education, the camera was huge too. The camera notebook combo was huge because, you know, the kids might find a bug and we could snap a photo of it. And then I could bring a lot of research back and tell them, like, this is amazing. Like, the bug expert in Colorado, you know, he's jealous. He's never seen one.
Yeah.
You guys got to see it. And they only come out of, like, you know, dead cottonwoods, you know, every so often. It's rare to see the adults or, you know, whatever it is. And maybe show them a sketch I made of it alongside the picture we took together. But yeah, in terms of the notebook, it's really, I like the jumbled nature of it because, speaking of storytelling and the natural world, I just think, you know, pure science, I love pure science, but pure science often fails to kind of interpret its results for the general public or to draw on history or literature or poetry and kind of weave things together in a way that, you know, makes sense of the environment around us in more than just a intellectual or statistical way. And so I guess I'm always looking for ways to overlap just different fields of interest and overlap scientific information with maybe more like local history, local legendary, anything. And one, you know, relationship in history that I've drawn a lot of meaning from is the relationship between John Steinbeck and Ed Ricketts.
Oh, yeah.
The novelist and the marine biologist, great friends down in Pacific Grove in California. And they were actually wanting to come up here together.
Well, yeah.
And
did they not make it quite this far? I mean, Ed Ricketts was definitely,
yeah.
They were, I can't remember the name of the boat. There's a number of people in town that are kind of connected with that story.
Yeah. I heard a rumor that, yeah, that there's still people connected. And
yeah. Ed Ricketts' daughter lives here.
Oh, okay.
Town. Yeah. And actually Jack Calvin, who is among them, lived here for many years and still has people that are related to him that live here.
Yeah. So, yeah, so the you know, they had a famous relationship where he really cross-pollinating ideas. Ed Ricketts was a polymath, and he loved classical music, philosophy, as well as being an expert capture of octopi in the intertidal, right? So in the late 30s, Steinbeck had finished The Grapes of Wrath, and it was very commercially successful, but it sapped a lot out of him because it was such a political novel and such a sort of intense novel to write about the Great Depression and the human migration and poverty and labor rights, that he basically was ready to give up being a novelist and just go into marine biology with his friend. And luckily, he didn't give up, but they did go on a trip around Mexico. It was basically like I want to think of my journal, like free-ranging, and they were collecting animals in the intertidal and trying to describe species, but they were also just sitting on top of the boat at night and drinking beers and kind of like musing on the state of the world. And, you know, The Log from the Sea of Cortez, which is the book that came out of that, is one of the most beautiful books because of the way it just draws so many strands in. And I think it's because of that kind of relationship they had and the fusion of natural history with other interest areas.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Do you, when you have these books, do you review them at all? I mean, I'd like, do you have an archive of field notebooks that you, do you go back over them or?
Yeah, I do from time to time, especially when I'm working on a project, you know, I often let my books gestate for a while, so
yeah.
I'll have random notes scribbled throughout maybe 10 different journals.
Mm.
Yeah, I have a wooden bookshelf that I built for them that they're all, you know, spilling and stacked on top of at this point and due for another bookshelf.
Yeah. It's, well, most of my stuff, if I write anything, it goes in my weblog pretty much. And so one of the things that I do is I have on my website a, you know, this, you know, today in history, essentially, of my weblog. So any post that was made on that calendar date in prior years is there. And I, that's one of my daily things, is I look back at each of those, which it's interesting. Sometimes I'm reminded of things that I had forgotten about. Not, I've been doing it enough years now that I've seen them, seen them enough times that I don't really, like, I'm a, oh yeah, I remember, but I don't always remember the dates. That's one thing that I find that, and that's one thing that's been nice about photos. And I imagine it's similar with journaling, and maybe even more so with journaling, is that when I have that hook into the memory, I can remember a lot more, some of which may be constructed memory, I suppose, but I can remember it, and where, and it's not that I would have forgotten it, but I would have no entry to that memory, without it. And so sometimes I'm a little surprised at how much, how many of the photos I can actually remember where I was when I took them, just looking at the photo. Sometimes I need the context. So if I see several photos, I can, oh yeah, that's right, I was there. Mm-hmm. Every once in a while, I have to go look at my, you know, GPS log data, you know, if I have it for that time, to go, oh yeah, that's right. And then I can start to make it. But most of the stuff that I have, and I mean, I have 80,000 photos or something from the last 20 years. So it's, you know, it's a lot of pictures over the years. Some of which I've, many of which I have yet to fully process. It's a work in progress. But yeah, what part of what you were saying there, you know, it reminded me, is like, and it's interesting just to think about, like, there's the worst case sort of stereotypical, I shouldn't say worst case, but kind of the most extreme case stereotypical birder is like the extreme lister. And all they care is that they, you know, the photons that bounced off that bird hit their retina,
right.
Check, and we're moving on. And like, they didn't have to get a look, good look. There's no sense of that. When I first was kind of just starting, I got my first telephoto lens so I could start taking pictures of birds consistently. And that's what got me started into birds. 'Cause before that I had taken pictures mostly of plants. And that's where I started. And I went out with somebody in town that had, it was kind of, you know, more of a casual birder, I would say, somebody that I knew. And I said, oh, I saw these, I think they were black turnstones. And he's like, oh, I haven't seen black turnstones. He'd lived up north for a while and was back in town and, you know, was living in town now. And so it's like, oh, I said, well, we can go down to the park. And so we went down to the park. He brought his spotting scope and his bird book. And we looked, and he looked and he was very, you know, sort of just kind of systematic and careful about it. And it's like, oh, these are surf birds. And I was like, oh, I've never heard of surf birds. I didn't know they were a thing. And at the time, they looked pretty identical to me. Now it's not hard for me to tell them apart at all. I like it from a glance, can just, even from a distance, mostly I can tell what they are. But at the time, like my brain hadn't made sense of those differences yet. And it was just kind of like, oh, those are kind of the same size, kind of the same color. And so they're all the same thing. And there's this interesting interpretive filter that is there doing that. But he, you know, he was very careful. And I ended up talking to him about his list. And he did keep a list, but he said he only wanted to put things on the list that he, you know, had seen well. It was like, and there was a certain, like, it was a very aesthetic thing for him. It was like, it was a certain, like, even if he got a good look through binoculars or something, like, that wasn't necessarily going to cut it. There had to have a certain aesthetic feel to it.
Really?
For him. Like, I think it was a chance to just sit there and, like, look at the book and look at the bird, mm-hmm. and have a chance to really kind of, experience the bird in a way. And that's what it meant for him to put a bird on the list. And so that's kind of a very, and that was one of the early, sort of my early experiences with somebody who is something of a birder. And since then I've come to learn about all the various styles of listing and, or not listing at all, you know, that people have to their birding. But it was, I really appreciated that in the end. It was just like, oh yeah, you can do that. And since then I've met people, like, there was a guy from, a couple from Australia. She didn't keep a list at all. She loved going out and looking at birds. She didn't keep a list. He kept a list. He had his checklist all pre-printed, like all the birds that he thought he might see with you know, bolding or different font for the ones that he thought were likely and ones that would be lifers for him and all of that. And he had this notebook. And we went out. And at the end of the day, you know, I was dropping them off where they were going to get back onto their cruise ship. And he said, do you mind if we just sit for a few minutes? I just want to review the things that we saw today. And so we went through that and he said, okay, yeah, check. And then, so he was checking there. And then I said, oh, we saw this too. And he goes, yeah, I don't know that I I don't know that I feel good about that one. Like we saw it, and I believe that I believe you, but I didn't feel like I like really saw it. Like I didn't know that I could have told what it was,
uh-huh.
And that was for him. That was his personal aesthetic about whether it went on the list or not. So, yeah, it's just interesting the way that people take that approach.
Yeah, it is. It's really cool in that. It's a hobby with kind of a wide enough spectrum of options that people can plug in their own way, from, yeah, those hardcore Twitcher listers to the amazing artists I've seen who just want to sketch what they see, traveler birders who just bird when they're traveling. You know, when I'm explaining to someone who, you know, just this morning I was hiking with some folks and, you know, got them cued in on varied thrush, got them cued in on my favorite bird, Pacific Wren, most notes per second of any bird song, so I've been told. I'm often able to share, you know, what I love about birding. And to me, as far as I can tell, there's five joys that it contains that you can plug into in various ways. One is the joy of being outdoors, pretty simple. One is the joy of constant learning. There's always more subspecies, plumages, you know, details of these birds to learn about, life histories. One is the joy of collecting. Like I mentioned, I'm very much a collector at heart and categorizer and organizer. Love looking at how many birds I've seen in all the different counties in Washington, you know?
Yeah.
One is the joy of competition, which for some people, they really tap into that, others not as much. And then the last one is the joy of the unexpected, because it's a treasure hunt.
Yeah.
And every time you go outside to go birding, you have a sense of what you'll probably see, but usually you find something that you weren't really expecting, and it's really exciting.
Yeah, those vagrants are there's something about that. It's kind of the what is it? Intermittent reinforcement, as they say, is the most powerful kind.
Yeah, and that, you know, goes back to the beauty of knowing your local landscape. Is like, even if it's a bird that you normally see over in this area, and it's like randomly hanging out in this park where they don't usually hang out. You know, that's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And when you don't know the place, like you don't, it's an interesting thing, because like when you come someplace new, it's all new, kind of, but you might see something unusual and you won't really have much appreciation for it, because it's like, you know, the first time I saw a red-breasted nuthatch here, they're not, like, they're irregular here. Most years, probably there's a few that move through. Some years they stick around for the winter, and occasionally they even nest here. But I had one at my feeder, one of the first years I was having a feeder, and I was like, oh yeah. And somebody's like, oh, I've never seen a red-breasted nuthatch. They're at my feeder. no big deal. It was another two or three years before I saw another one.
Yeah.
And I was like, I later came to appreciate that wasn't actually all that common. But I didn't know at the time. And so there's a different kind of layers of appreciation that you develop over time as you get to know the birds or the plants or whatever. So now with plants, it's similar. Like, I know them well enough that when I see an unusual plant, I'm like, that's kind of exciting as well. Granted, plants don't move around quite the same way that birds do. So it's a little less, you know, part of it for plants, it's exploring little nooks, mm-hmm. and little microhabitats or just a, you know, that is, so it draws me into places where I probably won't find any birds, really, but there might be an unusual plant, kind of thing. And exploring the little, you know, ravines or whatever, you know, places that you wouldn't, they're off the beaten path, basically. And so that it's a similar sort of thing, but experienced a little differently, because you go to the same place. Every once in a while, you'll see something you never saw before, plant-wise. But bird-wise, you know, because they're coming and going, you get that experience there. So it draws me out into the landscape, I guess.
Yeah, and that's exactly there is sort of a sixth joy that I've been really appreciating more and more lately, which is just this sense of when you're out, especially when I'm alone out in a forest or anywhere, and looking for birds, I can like very physically feel my eyes and my ears extending as senses, and kind of like all my brain and my thoughts are draining out because I'm so cued in on every little movement or every little, you know, little swishing sound in the underbrush or chirp note in the distance, and trying to figure out, you know, what's here and what's out there. And it feels very like disembodying in a very like meditative way. And it's a great way just to escape kind of, you know, my consciousness,
yeah,
which can feel like a trap at times. Or a hamster wheel.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a friend, somebody I work with who I'm pretty sure his book that he's just about to release is about mindfulness and nature connection, basically the ways that and looking a lot at the science kind of like how our connections with nature actually help relax and calm and kind of those benefits of meditation and so forth that people get are there to be had and maybe even more powerfully with your sort of like as you were describing that kind of that quiet mind state that comes on state of it's a deep awareness but a deeply relaxed awareness, like you're aware of what's going on. It's not that you've closed everything down and sort of like ensconced,
yeah.
but it's actually a connection outward and a sense of awareness within that.
But another thing I think about, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, is at times when I'm in the woods, I feel very frightened because it might be dense underbrush. It might be an area where bears are around or Sasquatch is around or who knows what. And that sort of, again, you know, my senses are extended and I feel very kind of like tuned to everything around. And there is kind of like a underlying like buzz of fear driving some of that. But it's not a bad fear. It's like, it like makes me feel really alive. And I wonder, cause the other thing I hate to see is folks who don't want to go out in the woods cause they're scared. You know, a snake's going to bite them or, you know, that don't have much experience with outdoors and basically kind of fear the unknown.
Yeah.
And all the terrible stories, you know, the shark in the water, or the snake in the grass or whatever.
So yeah, it's an interesting dynamic, right? Cause, I know somebody that has taken several trips to visit the Bushmen in Africa that, and there's a group there that are working to, sort of live as similarly as they can to how they have for tens of thousands of years, maybe even over 100,000 years in that area. And one, he said the story that, you know, they don't have modern weapons, you know, and there are lions there. Like it's not, and they have to be very aware, but they're also very relaxed, calm, peaceful people. But their awareness is so profound in that environment. You know, it's so well calibrated. Like they know they are so well tuned to the what the birds are doing. You know, and the birds mm-hmm. and the other animals, and that's giving them signals like from snakes. It's not just lions, but snakes and all these other things. And it's this interesting thing, whereas we live in our houses and we're pretty climate controlled and, you know, we don't have all of these experiences. We go out and there are bears around. And so you have this interesting, yeah, as you described that there, it's kind of this awareness born out of a knowledge that you're not necessarily the top of the food chain kind of thing. Like there are things that can happen. And when you know, I was thinking about just it's kind of an aside, you know, I was thinking about when people let their dogs go on the beach, for example, and the shorebirds fly up. I'm like, well, shorebirds need to be aware and reactive and stuff. So maybe that's not such a big deal. And then I thought, well, you know, the reason that's not really fair is because the dogs get to go home at night and have a meal, like no matter what. Right. They're
that's
safe.
True.
Right. There's no consequence for them to run out there and chase the shorebirds, a coyote or a wolf. Or, you know, or a fox or whatever, they might want to eat shorebirds, probably not the wolf, but the coyote or the fox would probably be happy to catch a shorebird and eat it. But it can't just run out there willy-nilly, you know, scaring them all the time because it's also got to survive. You know, yeah. it doesn't have a meal at home. And so there's this interesting, like, interplay of when we go out there, you know, what is our awareness? How do we create that sense of need to pay attention in that way, in that fuller way? Because it's very easy for us to go out there like the dogs, you know, and the dogs are far more aware than we are, you know, in a lot of cases. But we just go out and we're just tromping through, you know, sometimes we have our headphones on and it was just like we're in our little box moving through the woods. And there's no real consequence for us to do that. You know, it's better probably than us being in the house, but it's also not that same full sensory experience, you know. So, and there are a lot of people like scared of the dark or the mud or whatever. Like there's fear might not be quite the right word, but there's this distaste, this discomfort. And that's one of the things that you know, it takes time to kind of get through, I guess. But it is an interesting process for me. For whatever reason, maybe because I just grew up around here, I probably am not as wary of bears as I should be. And bears are the main thing here, other than you know, accidents,
right?
And weather, you know, falling or slipping and falling, or you know, tree falling could be a thing, I suppose, or getting caught out in weather and conditions that you're not prepared for. Those are kind of the things here. It's not really subtle things here that you have to worry about. And I don't, yeah, it's not something that I like to pay attention to what's going on. Actually, trying to find birds is what kind of drew me out, because I became obsessive about what bird is that. And I found a lot of them by hearing them. You can't see them. So then it's like, oh, that sounds different. Let me go try and find it. And so that really taught me that's how I expanded my hearing. At least I've tried to expand my sense of smell more. But it's not, that's something I have to remind myself of. There's no, I have a hard time, like it's hard to create the need for me. Like there isn't something out there that if I smell it, then I'll know, you know, although bears do smell, and I have smelled them before, but all these senses and how you can expand them. And then what happens when you do, and the kind of the synergistic way that they all work together, and you end up having experiences that you might not have had otherwise, is kind of an interesting process.
Yeah, and going back to identification, like smell and taste can be really big clues. And I know I've started tasting a lot more leaves and plants because it just like makes the diversity that much more visceral. It's really cool.
Yeah,
I just tasted licorice fern root first time a few months ago. And
what'd you think of it?
You know, it started out great, and then it got pretty bitter pretty fast.
There's the poisonous plants, but that's, you know, getting to know the hazards is an important like first step, and that's what helps people feel safe. What is the real risk? You know, it's that fear of the unknown. That is sometimes problematic, but it's interesting to become a connoisseur of berry flavor, for example, grown in different places or different bushes, and how do the berries differ in taste. It's a little nerdy maybe, but but there's a certain appreciation that comes from kind of that refinement.
I'm excited to find. I still haven't found there's a mushroom called a shrimp russula smells like shrimp apparently, but I haven't found one yet.
Yeah,
I'm ready.
Yeah, I've seen those. I don't know if I would describe it as shrimp smell, but
no.
but they grow here. It's kind of a seafood-ish smell. It's a little. I don't know. It wasn't super strong, the one that I smelled.
Okay.
It's always, and I always forget to smell the things. There's one mushroom that smells like corn silk tassels.
Oh, interesting.
You know, the corn tassels. And that's one of the key, an easy way to identify it. It's in an otherwise pretty difficult group, but. And I guess now they're saying that's a species complex, but you know, what are you going to do? Genetics are letting us differentiate things more effectively. But we're kind of at our hour here. And anything else you want to mention before we wrap up?
Not really. Just thanks for having me, and what a privilege to be able to visit a place like this.
Yeah, well, if you ever come back through, I'd be happy to talk to you again and hear a little bit more. Do you have any place that people can see your writing, or is that something that you just mostly do for yourself at this point?
Yeah, scattered around. Definitely Googling my name should pop some things up. And yeah, two books in the works.
Oh, all right.
And yeah, many on the horizon.
All right, sounds good. Well, thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a conversation I recorded back in mid-May with Chris Rurick, a visiting writer and naturalist. I want to thank him for taking some time out of his visit here to talk with me. And thank you for joining me here on the Sitka Nature Show this week. As always, you can find recordings of past shows at sitkanature.org/raven, or get on Facebook and like the Sitka Nature page there. I'd love to hear from you, hear what you're seeing out there, anything you're finding interesting. Please feel free to send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com. And I'll look forward to being back in a couple of weeks. Until then, this has been Matt on the Sitka Nature Show, KCAW, Sitka.